This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, Joe Biden's $700 million plan and a familiar former mayor who's backing it up, one-time presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg.
The reality is we can't afford not to make these investments or we will see the economy stagnate.
And Arthur Brooks, Harvard professor and contributor to The Atlantic, how America can move past the pandemic and how free market conservatives can feel okay about it.
There's only a private sector solution because capitalism and the free market economy are what's pulled us out of every crisis ever.
It's Thursday, July 9th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden rolling out his economic policy today. He's going to travel to Pennsylvania near his hometown of Scranton. The agenda slogan is, quote, build back better. His campaign team says that Biden will prioritize small business workers and plans to focus on inequalities that prevent minorities from reaching a fair economic playing field. We're going to hear a lot more about the plan from Biden campaign surrogate Pete Buttigieg, who's going to join the Squawk team.
Andrew, I was just trying to remember that broadcast news. What is it? Bring back better. That's a lot of alliteration for, remember that quote from broadcast news? I can't remember what it was, but yeah, bring back better. A lot of B's there.
Build Back Better is the name of the former vice president's economic recovery plan. That is the work of a task force between Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders. The key idea? Bring critical manufacturing back to the United States with incentives for companies and $700 billion in earmarked funding for government contracts, for American firms, and research and development. The campaign says this will create 8 million new jobs. If that sounds similar to President Trump's platform, it is.
Does anybody want this pen?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
Last year, Trump signed an executive order that would prioritize American manufacturers in certain federal contracts. But the Biden campaign says Trump's efforts aren't working, and contracts to foreign companies are up 30%. Vice President Biden has said he'd raise $3.8 trillion by increasing taxes on individuals making more than $400,000 a year and reversing corporate tax cuts. Now, this rollout today will include a speech outside Biden's hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, and his one-time rivals from the Democratic primary race, remember that? It was just a few months ago, are turning out in force today to support the former vice president and his plan. One of them joined us on Squawk Box, Mayor Pete, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. Here's Joe.
I'm just going to call you Mayor Pete. I guess we all just feel comfortable. We feel comfortable.
That's what everybody does around here. So
comfortable
feel free.
Enough
Thanks
to
for
do
having
that.
Me up.
All right, Mayor Pete, I'm going to do that. So we understand the primary process, and you understand it as well as anyone, and we've seen it on both sides. Sometimes there is a tendency to move towards the respective bases with some of the programs. And then when it comes to governing, maybe you become more centrist. And I'm just going to tell you, here's the headline for this, Mayor Pete. Biden to map an economic path delaying progressives' biggest plans. And I think Kayla alluded to it, that he's going to call for a moderate approach towards reviving the U.S. economy. Is that how you see it? And is that the right prescription to win?
Well, I think there's a lot of boldness in the level that Vice President Biden wants to invest in America. And I think that's not only a progressive priority, but something that people across the aisle can get on board with, too. I think it's in keeping with Joe Biden's instincts to bring people together. But I think it's also, in practical terms, what makes sense for the economy. We need to invest in our own competitiveness, both in order to grow here at home and in order to compete with increasingly powerful economic competitors like China. We need to make sure we're less dependent on supply chains for critical goods and infrastructure, like we're seeing right now with pharmaceutical issues, on countries like China. And we need to make sure that American workers come first. To me, that's bedrock for what the Democratic Party is about. But I do agree with you that you don't have to be a rock-ribbed Democrat to see why this is a good economic policy.
Well, some of the plans were pretty expensive, as you know, and it was pre-pandemic, and it was pre-25 trillion, wherever we are right now. So this has cost a lot and inflicted a lot of economic damage. And you know, hopefully we're going to come out of this, but it might take years. So I mean, is there something to that, that it's not the, we're not in the same position to be able to maybe be as free spending with some of the Democratic programs? Do you think, do you agree with that? And we're going to need to try to pay down some of this debt with higher taxes?
Well, you know, as Democrats go, I've been one of the first to talk about deficits and the debt. But the reality is we can't afford not to make these investments or we will see the economy stagnate. And since we're in a moment of historically low interest rates, and since these kinds of investments, every time America has done them, have paid off, investing in our competitiveness, in our infrastructure, in our manufacturing base, frankly, they have a much higher rate of return than tax cuts. So as economic stimulus goes, I think this is the right way forward. Of course, we got to be smart about the investments that we make. And of course, you can't get something for nothing. But if you look at the overall picture of where our economy is headed, we don't have a choice, and we can handle these kinds of investments if we make them before it's too late.
So Mayor Pete, I think that lowering corporate taxes helped corporations become more competitive, bring money back. I think it was somewhat responsible for what were pretty good economic times before the pandemic in terms of historically low unemployment rates across the board and some of the deregulation. The vice president is going to reverse at least a portion of the corporate tax cuts. Do you not think that plan helped with the economy? Do you disagree that lower corporate rates were a boom for the U.S. economy and it won't matter to reverse them for jobs?
Yeah, I'm very skeptical that those rate cuts should get most of the credit. And by the way, those rate cuts led directly to exploding deficits. It's part of the reason why, oddly enough, not to be too partisan about this, but across my lifetime, 100% of Democratic presidents have seen deficits go down, and 100% of Republican presidents have seen deficits go up. Look, you can't get something for nothing. And what we've got to decide is what's a responsible level of taxes that will deliver the kind of investments that make an economy competitive. Right. And this isn't something we have to just use our imagination for. We can look at the evidence. And the evidence across American history is that when we're making robust investments with responsible but not excessive taxation, the economy grows.
But it just we've talked about it earlier that right now with where American business is and how important it is to get the unemployment rate back down, it seems like not the most ideal time to raise corporate taxes. Now, we're going to need to pay down a lot of what we've spent and maybe, you know, you'd raise it on wealthy individuals, but that may not raise enough either. Are you for a blanket raise in the marginal rate, and to what level do you think what would you advise Vice President Biden to propose for a marginal rate across the board?
Well, I would advise him to look at the evidence and find levels of taxation that are consistent with growth as they have been historically. Now, of course, in American history, the economy has grown much quicker under much higher marginal tax rates. But I don't think we have to go back to what it was like in the 60s or in the 70s, even though, again, that was a period of in many of those phases, a lot of productivity growth. Look, the bottom line is you've got to pay for what you get, and we should be able to strike a balance in the United States. But what we can't do is continue with these deficit exploding tax cuts that we were told would pay for themselves. You can check. They didn't. And now, you know, that was before we got to the situation we are now with the deficit. It's why we need to make sure we're looking at the investment side as well as the cost side. And what I really appreciate about the plan that the vice president's laying out is it does both.
Mayor Pete, just wanted to, we wrestle with this issue of taxes all the time. So I just wanted to press you on two questions related to it. One is just simply the timing of a tax increase. And it's the question we asked the vice president when he joined us now more than a couple weeks back. And he said he would do it immediately, even amidst this. And the question I say is, to the extent there are small business owners out there right now that are clearly struggling and trying to get up on their feet, seeing a tax increase right in front of them, just make the case, if that's the case you want to make, in terms of the timing.
First of all, of course, there's going to be a look at conditions on the ground. I mean, the last 4 months have shown us in really blunt terms how quickly things can change. And I know that a new administration will make sure that every step it takes is consistent with what the right thing is to do based on what we see around us. But what we also know is that small business will benefit from the kinds of investments that the vice president is proposing, and that this country will be a more competitive one and a more economically successful one when we're investing in the foundations. No country can get away with disinvesting in education and infrastructure and research the way we have for very long. And the longer you go disinvesting in all that, the sooner it's going to catch up to you for small and big business alike. And, you know, we've already reached a point where even when there were low unemployment rates, the American standard of living was not secure. Life expectancy going down. It raises questions about how our economy has been lined up. This is a historic opportunity to make sure that it's working for more Americans.
And Mayor Pete, I just want to follow up with the other big debate we have around this table a lot is about wealth, the wealthy and philanthropy. Yesterday, Warren Buffett gave away $2.9 billion, and which is a great thing. And philanthropy, by the way, has helped even during this pandemic in a meaningful way. But oftentimes, those shares are never taxed, as we all know. And so the government will never be a beneficiary, and other taxpayers won't be a beneficiary of those successes. Do you think philanthropy should be taxed in any way?
Well, I think it would make more sense for that to happen on the front end. Look, it's wonderful when there are these major commitments, generous commitments by individuals. But we've also got to ask how things got so unequal in the first place, because if a little bit more of that was making its way into a democratically guided process, in other words, the kinds of research and development that that invent trillion-dollar ideas like the internet itself and space travel, we know our country's better off. And we got to ask where the balance is. I would argue, look, think about it this way. In the United States right now, there is not one county, not one, where a full-time minimum wage worker can afford a two-bedroom apartment. We're talking about somebody who works for a living in a job, full-time, can't afford a two-bedroom apartment. I would argue that if that weren't the case, if we had higher wages and more public investment, we wouldn't need to lean on philanthropy quite as much as we did.
Hey, Mayor Pete, the one thing that Vice President Biden's plan has in common with President Trump's is that it really leans into Made in America, and not just from a position of rhetoric. There looks like there are going to be real incentives and real penalties to companies if they're not making things in America. Do you think globalization is dead?
I don't think we have to choose between closing ourselves off and investing in our own country. On the contrary, I think in a global market, we are more competitive when we are starting right here at home. Look, Made in America is really good news, and the Vice President's Buy America initiative is really good news for us here in the so-called Rust Belt, where we know that we are capable of producing some of the finest goods in the world. But there are so many loopholes, there are so many waivers in the system. And as I think you all have reported, you know, offshoring's actually gone up an awful lot under this administration. So I don't view this as like the president kind of picking a fight with every country we can. I view it as an opportunity for us to make sure that taxpayer dollars benefit American firms and workers first. And then, of course, because we're so confident in the quality of our workers and our products, we can go out into a global marketplace and win there, too.
Mayor Pete, I was just trying to figure out, checking some of your math on the Democrats in terms of the deficits. Just, I mean, I know that President Obama tried to bring down the yearly deficit, but he added quite a bit of debt over the 8 years. I mean, more than
can you name me one Democratic president who served in my lifetime who left office with a bigger deficit than
I'm not talking about deficit. I'm talking about adding total debt. We went from $10 trillion to almost $20 trillion under the Obama administration. That's my only point. I mean, that's a little bit of debt, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that's cyclical, of course, because he took office at the trough of the, up until now, the worst economic shock of my lifetime. But yeah, look, again, I think we should, frankly, more than is sometimes fashionable in my party, I think we should pay attention to things like deficits and the debt. But the way we pay attention to them is to balance spending and taxes, and also in a moment like this, okay, not to be afraid to make the investments that are going to keep our economy growing.
We got to run our where will we see you next if the vice president does win? Is there a job? Can you tell us what looks good? What you got your eye on?
you know, right now I've got my eye on making sure he does win, and then okay. I'll do whatever I can to support the Biden administration, whether right. it's an opportunity to serve inside the government or on the outside in some way. We've all got to make ourselves useful right now.
I'm going to go with the Mayor Buttigieg for the formal goodbye. Thank you. We appreciate it, Mayor Pete.
Next on Squawk Pod, does college help build happiness? College dropout turned classical musician turned Harvard professor and author Arthur Brooks explores how to build a fulfilled life, whether it's on a university campus or a wheat farm in Idaho, and what makes it all uniquely American.
Entrepreneurs saying it's all about starting a business. That's the entrepreneurial economy. Wrong. The American experience is the startup life.
This is Squawk Pod. Here's Joe Kernan.
You got to listen to this to Arthur coming up here, Andrew. I don't know if you read all the notes, but I would like to just talk about his son, but we got to talk about important other things. The pandemic has colleges reevaluating their plans for this fall. Some say classes will be held online. Others say campus will be open, leading to a lot of questions about learning in the age of Zoom. Our next guest is a contributing writer for The Atlantic. He recently wrote about the value of college and whether it truly brings happiness as part of how to build a life series, which if I had known that, I would have ordered it because people constantly tell me I need a life. Is it a primer on that? There's a 12-step program. Arthur Brooks joins us this morning. He's also a professor at Harvard and American Enterprise Institute President Emeritus. Always great to see you, Arthur. And I'll tell you, we got to talk about getting back to work and the pandemic and all these things. But just philosophically, I always like talking to you because you're so positive and you could be my, you know, I could use you. I'd like to lay down on a couch like once a week and talk to you. Really, I would. So you come from a family of academics. Your father was a professor. You're a professor. Grandfather was a professor. Your first son, you know, valedictorian, goes to some great college. Second son says, I don't want to go to college, Dad. And you're like, what do we do? So you go back and forth. You finally back him on his decision. And he goes and gets a great job outdoors in Idaho. And as you said, is tired every day, gets up early, fully lives life. Does that for a while and then joins the Marine Corps, which he always wanted to do. What is wrong with that? And what can we learn from that? What can we learn from that?
We can learn a lot from that. You know, we have this culture of, and by the way, Joe, you're welcome on my couch absolutely anytime. And it's you brighten my day every time I talk to you. So it's not just one way, man. I love talking to you, too.
I appreciate that, Arthur. Thank you.
So my boy, Carlos, I mean, he really broke the mold. And here's the deal. I mean, my wife and I, we both dropped out of school. I was a classical musician for a long time. She actually quit high school to sing in a rock band, which is not something, you know, for all the young people listening, this is not what I recommend. But, you know, we're pretty free thinkers on this. But, you know, our son went to this pretty nice preparatory school. And he comes to us about this time 2 years ago and says, Dad, I don't want to go to college. I can't face it. I just can't face it anymore. And so he went out and he got this job working 12, 14 hours a day on a wheat farm in Idaho and did that and made a bunch of money. And then he joined the Marines. And he's, you know, he built his own life. And here's the key thing that he really taught me. Each of us has an enterprise under our control. We think of startups, you know, people watching Squawk Box, the best show on TV, for sure. A lot of entrepreneurs saying it's all about starting a business. That's the entrepreneurial economy. Wrong. The American experience is the startup life. Each one of us has all of this stuff under our control. We can build our own lives, and America won't come back really the way where it should be. America won't be truly great until each one of us lives the startup life like my son Carlos taught me to live. And it was a huge learning experience for me. And I tell you, I couldn't be prouder of him.
Yeah, you even tried to find out whether college brings happiness. And you said there's a slight correlation, but it wasn't a double blind study. You don't know what other things are going on in a person's life that correlates with going to college. There may be no correlation whatsoever, although we're not saying don't go to college. People seem to have more productive life. I don't know. That's what I've been told. It made me think about it myself. So how are we going to reopen, Arthur? Let's get back to the task at hand right now in terms of the schools. And Harvard is trying to deal with that. So is Penn. So are, you know, middle schools, elementary schools. Everybody has got this issue to do it safely because we all want to do it, though.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, the big problem with it, it really isn't, to a very large extent, just the liability around the students. It has to do with the faculty. So, you know, up here at Harvard, I'm like the youth movement. It's and I'm 56. It's just a lot of the professors are at real risk if they contract COVID. And so they can't be, you know, we can't put the faculty in the position of interacting with a lot of people that might be carriers of this disease. So the college here at Harvard is splitting up the freshmen and seniors. And then most of the graduate schools are entirely by Zoom. And that's the way it looks like it's going to be in 2021. And that seems like the safest option, at least for the administrators. But we can't do this forever. I mean, Goldman Sachs has been really clear that the most important thing based on their research and my colleagues at AEI, and you know, you have Scott Gottlieb on a lot. Masking is the most important thing that you can do. Social distancing as prudent, but the idea of constant shutdowns, especially start and stop, that's not a great policy.
You know, Arthur, I don't think I've talked to you about you know, how to be a free market AEI capitalist in an age where earlier this week we heard the government gave $1.6 billion to develop a vaccine. We've got PPP. The government is saving our collective butts. And it does the government, do free market types get a once in a 100-year pass on saying that everything should be settled in the marketplace? Because I think I said there's no capitalists in foxholes, in pandemic foxholes.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that Adam Smith always talked about is that there's certain roles for government, and one of those roles is the creation of public goods, which will be underproduced by private markets, or, you know, crime or pollution or monopoly. Those are legitimate functions for government. The problem is not that. The problem is not that the government is trying to help us find a vaccine against the pandemic. The problem is that the government is in every nook and cranny of our lives and growing by the second. That's the real problem. So you could be a free market conservative like you, Joe, and say, look, absolutely, the government should do national security up one side and down the other. The government should do these policies, should help us develop a vaccine, and at the same time shouldn't control every element of our lives. Those are completely consistent philosophies.
All right. So you see, this is, I'm thinking about like laying down and let you tell me how to think about a lot of these things, because I struggle with a lot of these things. Is there a private sector solution, a growth solution out of this this morass that we find ourselves in terms of $25 trillion that, you know, debt and the Fed and everything else?
Yeah, there's only a private sector solution because capitalism and the free market economy are what's pulled us out of every crisis ever. Now, that doesn't mean the government doesn't have a role. The government has a very important role, but the idea of the government saving the economy, that's not correct.
Who would you raise
government can do a lot.
Who would you raise taxes on right now, Arthur? Would you raise taxes on corporate? I mean, I'm starting to think we need to raise taxes on somebody, but corporations are the ones. I don't know if those are the things we need to rescind, those tax cuts, because that's why, you know, it brings jobs back, hopefully, and you know, and creates jobs. But somebody, middle class and upper class, we need a tax hike probably to pay for this. No?
Yeah, but there's another way to do it, too. I mean, I agree with that. But there's one thing that we haven't thought of before. How many assets does the federal government own that it actually could divest itself of and inject those into the private sector economy to productive and efficient use? We need to be thinking more carefully, more seriously about all the stuff that the federal government owns that's worth trillions and trillions of dollars. This is our, Joe, this is our privatization moment, when we can actually pay back some of the money that we've spent, and at the same time get a better economy, the economy that we really should have and we wanted from the very beginning. This could be, we're going to have to pay more, but this could also be a win-win with respect to the federal government shrinking.
Okay, I have an Ivy League person once in here, a co-Ivy Leaguer.
Andrew. No, Arthur, It's to the same issue that Joe was just talking about in terms of taxes,
yeah.
Which is, I think that there are people who look at this particular moment and say, we created effectively an insurance policy for corporations. Shouldn't they have to pay effectively a premium on that insurance? And by the way, we've done that for the businesses, but we haven't necessarily done that at the same level for individuals and their health care and all these other component mm-hmm. parts. I'm with Joe, actually, in that I don't know if raising taxes on corporations is necessarily the right answer insofar as it makes it harder to employ more people. I do wonder whether the wealthiest among us need to pay more in the same way that workers, frontline workers especially, you know, went to work in hospitals and went to work at the cash registers at Walmart, and that was their contribution during this pandemic, and that those of us who've been blessed to make money during this period should our contribution should be in the form of higher taxes. What do you think of that?
I think that that's going to wind up what happens anyway. I think, you know, ultimately, the government is going to have to find some way to float what we've done fiscally, and they're going to go where the money actually is, which is with the people who are making the most money. So whether that's the moral solution or not, I think that's the practical solution, and that's where things are going to wind up. We're going to wind up with marginally higher tax rates. I think we're going to find, a new way of actually tax. We're probably going to have to be more creative about how we tax consumption better with some carve outs for people who are really at the margins. I think that's where we're going to wind up. So whether someone likes it or not, I think that that's what we're going to get.
So you're a French horn player, the Barcelona orchestra. Now you're a professor. Mm-hmm. One of your sons is working 16 hours on a wheat farm, and he's now in the Marine Corps. Does he take after your wife? Can you? There's no way you could do any of those things, Brooks.
I don't know. Yeah, that's true.
What about
he's
your,
a pretty tough guy.
What about your French horn fingers if you're out there mending fences? It's not happening
I'm
for
telling you.
You.
It's not happening. I'm a delicate soul, Joe.
I know you
I'm an artistic type. Yeah, what can I tell you?
I know. So, okay, but we got to go. I'm going to turn it. But when you say Squawk Box, best show on television, I mean, you're talking just cable, or were you talking across the board? What about streaming and all these other things? So you mean
I'm talking universally. I mean, the people who are not watching us, these are the people who are missing out, not just on tips on actually how they can become more prosperous, but how they can become happier.
Right.
Everybody should be watching.
Yeah, you wrote a book about how we all got to get along. How's that working?
It's it's working for me in my life, and I want it to work for you. I want it to work for you, Joe.
I'm trying. We're trying, but it's just
love everybody. Come on, man.
Okay, love everybody. Disagree, but you can disagree without being disagreeable. How's that?
That's not only that, you can disagree and love people more. It's a miracle, actually.
All right.
And this is ultimately what. Look, we're going in the wrong direction, but I see better times ahead.
Good. That's optimistic. Thank you. We're one day closer to whatever is coming. Hopefully, not that freight train headed right at us. Anyway, thank you, Arthur. I'll toss it over to you now.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay.
I love Arthur. Feel the love, Joe. Just feel it.
More Squawk Pod when we come back. You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Joe.
How far does a Tesla go? Can you go on a? Have you thought about that, you guys? How far can you
get? Can't go cross country.
So you can't go on
Tesla. You can do about 250 miles before. But you know, on the system, if you have a Tesla, Joe, is they tell you on the map where the next Tesla charging station is, so
that's
you could drive to the
fast
station.
It's
go
a fast
to
fast charge now.
How
right?
long does it take to charge? What's the fastest charge you got?
I don't know if you get the full tank, but I think you can. I think if you do it for 20 minutes, 25 minutes. You can get a good 100, 200 miles out of it, yeah.
Waffle House.
It is not a car you're taking on a cross-country trip for.
Put the chargers near a Waffle House. You know, you think I don't think about these things?
I think the idea, right.
You think I don't think about these things, huh?
You don't do car rides with young kids. We don't stop. We get up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and you drive, and you bring your stuff with you because an extra hour or 2 hours on the road. No, thank you.
I can definitely kill 20 minutes at a Waffle House. I'm telling you.
You know what I bought recently?
My eyes. I could do that morning and the afternoon. Biscuits with gravy twice.
We bought a luggable loo.
A what?
A luggable loo is the toilet. It's a luggable loo. It's like a bucket with a toilet seat on it. You bring it along. Because if you're going on a long road trip and you don't want to go
the car?
Into the restroom,
yeah, that's
in the
great,
bathroom.
Becky. That's just why go to a restroom? Just do it right in the car. That's awesome.
I want to correct myself,
you have
guys.
Young children anymore?
You're talking about quail, Matt? That's disgusting.
No, I'm talking about young children.
Oh,
dummy.
Okay. All right. Jesus. Anyway,
guys, just so you know, on a Model S, I was wrong. On a Model S, on a single charge,
400.
If you have the long range Model S, apparently you can go 402 miles.
400. That's better.
So
that's impressive.
402 miles.
Yeah. That's a ways.
Is the EPA rating?
Right. And the Model S can do that in about an hour and a half. So that's pretty good if you put it on whatever that is. What's that speed called?
Ludicrous mode.
All right.
That's the podcast for today. On our rundown tomorrow, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, the leader of America's third largest city, says the COVID crisis has pushed urban neighborhoods down, but not out.
People are slowly starting to come back into cities, and cities really are where it's at. The vibrancy of the cultural life, you can't replicate that anyplace else.
Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to Squawk Pod, share this podcast with a friend, and send us your thoughts on Twitter at Squawk CNBC.
Squawk!
We'll meet you back here tomorrow.